We've been camping together for 3 months now in the book of Luke. And today our campsite is Luke chapter 6, verses 12 to 19. So far, camping together has been exciting. The plot has been moving along. Jesus has done spectacular things. He's said profound things that leave us on Sunday morning scratching our heads. And now the plot today comes to almost a complete halt. By the end of these 30 minutes, almost nothing has happened. Nothing to raise your pulse. This could be a really good morning to get an early start on your Sunday nap, because it's not going to move very far at all. And yet, Luke chapter 6, 12 through 19 could be the passage that has been the most influential passage in my Christian life. I was standing as a young man on a precipitous edge. I was on a cliff, and I was about to jump. All my friends were jumping into a world of unconstrained passion and fun. They had just discovered alcohol and marijuana and girls. And they were jumping in without limit. And they were trying to persuade me to jump with them. My girlfriend also thought that I should jump. She wanted us in our relationship to throw off all limits and fully express ourselves to one another. She was so mad at my reluctance, she went and talked to my friends and had my friends heckle me for not jumping with her off the cliff. Everyone wanted me to jump, but I was reluctant. I just had this reluctance. Like, how many parties is life about Friday night? Is it about vacation? How many girls are gonna make me happy? How much alcohol does it take to finally satisfy my thirst? I was tempted but reluctant. And there was another cliff that was appealing to me. I was a thoughtful guy. I stayed up late asking deep questions. And no one was giving me any answers. I was tempted to just slip away from it all. I was a good athlete, and I had ribbons posted all over my room, and I was a good student, and I just, how many classes was I going to take? How many degrees would I get? How many races did I have to win? It just all felt sort of like repetitive, and I couldn't see why I should keep going. So the question was, should I slip out my bedroom window and go to the party this Friday night? Or should I slip into my mother's medicine cabinet and grab a bottle of whatever I could find and just slip out of this life? This was where I found myself as a young man. And if it wasn't for people reading Luke chapter 6, I would not be here today. Luke 6 was the only thing that could talk me off the edge of the cliff. It reads, "In these days, Jesus went out to the mountain to pray. And all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles: Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew and Matthew, and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot. and Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and all the crowd sought to touch him. For power came out from him, and he healed them all. Do you see the plot that I'm dealing with this morning? He prays. He steps down off the mountain. He touches a few guys. And then he goes a little farther, steps down a little further, and touches some other people. That's it. That's all we've got this morning. So we're going to do this passage like my friends in Texas do tacos. If you're in Texas, when I go to Texas, the first thing I want to do is go to the gas station. Not to get gas, but to get tacos. This is where you find a good taco, is at a gas station. And they serve these things up always with lime. And what you're meant to do is you're meant to cut that lime open. You're meant to squeeze that thing. And that lime covers everything on that plate. Right? And it mixes together, flavoring everything. This is a New Testament lime we have here today. We're going to cut it open and go slowly and squeeze. Right? We know this is important because Jesus spends the entire night praying. That's an important detail. We don't know what he's saying to his Father, but we know what he's going to do next is very important because he's in prayer with his Father all night about it. It's a big moment. Now, Jesus was a Jewish rabbi. We have to squeeze this to understand what's going on here. Right? It doesn't say it in our text, but throughout the Gospels, everyone calls him rabbi or teacher. Often it's translated teacher. The Pharisees call him this. The Sadducees, rich people call him this. Ordinary people call him this. His disciples call him this. It's what he's called. And so he for some reason, gladly accepts the role of a Jewish rabbi. But that's not something we have today. You don't run into rabbis all the time. We're not familiar with that term. A rabbi was kind of like a distinguished professor. Ooh, in Corvallis, we know what that's like. Or a best-selling author that comes into the room and everyone wants to hear. Oh, did you hear? They're here. At the auditorium, so-and-so's coming. Let's get tickets. Let's go listen. Right? When the rabbi, he was traveling around from synagogue to synagogue, and when he came, the religious leaders themselves would pepper him with questions. He was the expert on life. The rabbi was. The professor. The distinguished teacher. Jewish kids would go to school until they were 12, right? And then they were done, Malachi, Liam. That was it. They were all done. And then they would go join their parents in their trade. Unless you were like a top student, then you would continue going until you were 17, right? But at 17, everybody was done. Everybody was done. Unless you were like abnormally sharp with the Torah and such a promising student. There probably wasn't one of these in your town, but the best in the region could apply to try to follow a rabbi, right? The best of the best. And if he was accepted, he would then win the lottery and win kind of an apprenticeship with this rabbi. Apprentice is a good word because rabbis were traveling. There were no classrooms. There were no multiple choice exams with rabbis. So they were kind of not like professors. They were kind of like journeymen, right? Where you come under an electrician or a plumber and you go down into the crawl spaces of life where you really come in contact with lots of different things. The rabbi was an expert on life. Life lived out in the community, and the classroom was the world. You're right up in each other's personal space. And Jesus is willing to accept this title. He uses this learning matrix, rabbi and disciple, to teach those men and us how we're meant to relate to Jesus. But before he does that, he turns the whole thing on its head. So he is going to show us that disciples are meant to follow their rabbi, they're meant to listen to their rabbi, and they're meant to multiply. We're going to take each one of those in turn this morning, but before we get there, we have to talk about how he turns this whole thing on his head. He doesn't select the top students. He's very unconventional in how he picks his disciples. These men do not qualify to follow a rabbi. They should not have been selected. They never would have applied to follow the rabbi. You start out with the men we've already heard of in Luke chapter 5. Peter, James, and John are fishermen. That means they finished at 12 and then went and cast their nets. They didn't even try. They didn't go till they were 17. They didn't try to apply to follow a rabbi. They do not belong with Jesus. You have Matthew, a tax collector, the most hated of all people in the Jewish community because he has kind of served as a traitor. He's teamed up with the occupying Romans who are, you know, pushing down the Jewish people constantly. Everybody hates Matthew. And Jesus taps him to be one of his disciples. He taps Simon the Zealot, who thinks that, oh, the way we fight these oppressors, Rome, is with the sword. He's a revolutionary trying to overthrow, plotting, how can we get rid of Rome and the tax collectors? How do we do this? Several of these guys on this list only show up on this list. They're nowhere else in the whole book. We don't know anything about them. These are common, ordinary folk that have nothing in common. Can you imagine the reaction? Wait, me? Did you say, wait, I'm a fisherman. I'm a tax collector. I don't belong here. Come, follow me. And if you're reading this, you're meant to see yourself in this story right here and throughout. This was the word for a follower, not just for these 12 men, but for everybody that would follow these 12 men. There was no other term. We didn't call them evangelicals at this point. We didn't even call them Christians. They were disciples. It's the only word. I mean, Christian shows up 3 times later, way later. Disciple shows up 269 times. It's the word. It's the matrix Jesus chose for us to learn how we're meant to follow him. We're meant to be disciples, you and I. And it's come as you are. It's not I have to earn my way and try to qualify to be a disciple. It's a call for all people. No matter what passport you have, your resume, your health records, your sexual history, your educational experience, what's in your bank account, Jesus is turning this in a Roman Jewish world? This is unheard of. To just invite the people off the streets? He's turning it on his head. But he also is holding out the rabbi-disciple relationship as an example. He's okay with it. He's wanting us to learn from this kind of relationship. This is how I'm going to deal with men. I expect them, just like a rabbi expects his disciples. I expect my disciples to follow, to listen, and to multiply. Let's take each of those in turn. If you went with a Jewish rabbi, if he did accept you and you were to follow him like happens here in our text, it would mean you have to leave behind your life. And you would have to put down your nets. You would have to leave your tax collector booth. You'd have to put down your sword, Simon the Zealot. And you would have to follow your rabbi. And you would live with him. You would eat beside him, sleep beside him, and you would learn. You're not just leaving one place. You're also having to put down what you think is going to bring you the good life. And it's a new paradigm. I believe this rabbi can teach me how to live a good life that I actually don't. I can't engineer my own life, and I think he has something to teach me. Now, in my pocket, I have some pills. This sermon has three hard pills that we have to swallow. Some medicine that is going to have some trouble going down. And this is the first, that Rabbi Jesus demands that you follow him. This is a tough pill to eat in Oregon, the end of the Oregon Trail. Where we came out, we are rugged individualists. We live in the backdrop of this church, if I'm facing this way, is one of the most prestigious universities in the world. That celebrates innovation and engineering. We take pride in our ability to engineer the good life. And it can easily take offense that Jesus is saying, you cannot do this without me. If Mary Poppins was here, she'd give us a spoonful of sugar to help this medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote the book on this. As his life was on the line with the Nazis trying to get rid of guys like him. And he doesn't help with the pill going down. But he helps us see what's on the line here. What Jesus is doing with these men in our text. Bonhoeffer says, to follow the rabbi Jesus is to be dragged out of your relative security into a life of absolute insecurity. From a life which is observable and calculable into a life where everything is unobservable and fortuitous. Out of a realm that's finite and into a realm of infinite possibilities, breaking through every program, every ideal, every set of laws. Besides Jesus, nothing else has any value. He alone matters. When we are called to follow Christ, we are summoned to an exclusive attachment to his person. This gracious calling bursts all bonds to rule following which we have given authority in our lives. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Oh, it's bitter. I don't want to hear that. I like my security. I like the observable and the calculable. Where is Mary Poppins? But Rabbi Jesus does make a claim on our life, but he's not the only one making a claim on our life. We're all disciples to something or someone. It's not like this is exclusive to Jesus. We pledge our allegiances intentionally or subconsciously to all kinds of dreams and narratives and people and programs. My neighbors have one that I think they don't realize they kind of share. They like to approach life like a buffet table, where they pick their favorite things and make their own rabbi. It's like Build-A-Bear. You build your own rabbi. And it feels really inclusive, like no one's left out and I don't impose my preferences on you. We can all have our own rabbis and follow our own things. But then they get really mad at each other over the fence because they pick different things and they're very offended. It's kind of a funny thing that happens. Like, oh, their music is too loud. Oh, their dog won't stop barking. Oh, those Smith children. So loud. They're everywhere. This is private property. It happens. It happens, right? And we're sort of like, we're grumpy because our values aren't shared. And so we have to start to distance ourselves in the name of tolerance because my tastes differ from your tastes. It's also an enormous amount of pressure for me to put on myself. If I create my own rabbi, then everything bad that happens in my life is kind of my fault. All my successes I get to celebrate, but all my failures kind of fall back on me, and the shame starts to pile up. Can't share values with others, and everything is kind of based on this own thing I've constructed, based on my ever-fluctuating emotions. It's up and down. We all have rabbis. Is it your family tradition, your career, your political affinities? Is it a mixture of all those things? These are the terms that Christianity offers too. You have to decide if you're going to follow Rabbi Jesus. And if he is who he said he is, then the best thing that Matthew and Philip and Bartholomew can do is just follow and believe that he is the expert on this life. It's a hard pill to swallow. So Rabbi Jesus asks us to follow, and he also expects that his disciples will listen. Next week, we'll camp at the end of chapter 6. From here, Jesus starts to teach his disciples. And I didn't mark this. Here it is. In verse 40, he says, "A disciple is not above his rabbi, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his rabbi." Jesus fully expects that they will listen to his teachings and they will seek to imitate him. It appears we have arrived at our second hard pill to swallow, if you're picking up on what's happening here. Jesus says, "I have authority over you, and you're meant to listen to me." Like, we don't like this idea that we can't just pick whatever rabbi we want, and we certainly don't like the idea of Jesus being an authority figure. Ugh. I mean, and if you look at authority figures, some of the most heinous abuses of authority have happened by the church. If you have a bad taste for authority, a lot of that's because of the church. And we think that it seems like the last of these men to die was John. And John, it seems like, history's a little shady because it's a long time ago, but it seems like John was contemporaries or maybe discipled three early church leaders. A guy named Clement in Rome, like the third maybe leader in the Church of Rome. Ignatius in Antioch, and Polycarp in Smyrna. And at this time when John dies, there's about 40 churches spread out throughout the Mediterranean. And we have 10 letters, 7 from Ignatius, 1 from Clement, 1 from Polycarp, that you can read. And you can get a flavor for what the early church was like after these 12 die. And it appears, it's beautiful literature, it appears like they're still disciples, and they still it smells a lot like the New Testament. They're still loving the poor. They're still loving each other. They're gathering together across the Mediterranean. But towards the end of this period, of the second generation of disciples, there's a lot of like false teaching that starts to circulate, and Ignatius starts to talk about he's on his way to die in Rome, and he's in his letters back to these churches, these seven churches, he's starting to feel like we need to have some sort of like way to preserve the truth, some sort of leadership. We need to establish leaders that can make sure this garbage is not in here, and we can hold true to the apostles' teaching. So you start to have leaders, which is not a bad thing, but then with time, you can start to watch through church history, the leaders become too powerful, and they start to abuse that leadership. You get into the Middle Ages, and I'm trying to explain to my kids like why a pope would order war, right? Authority makes us, it's a bitter pill. It's bitter because I also like to think I know something. I'm a bad listener. I like to solve problems on my own. I don't like asking for help. You know? This is a bitter pill because it feels constraining. We live in the land of the free, and I don't like people putting limitations on me. But isn't it silly to think that freedom is being free from all constraint? Would any of you like to live in a place where everybody was free of all constraints? Imagine my relationship with Mindy. If we just, everything was governed by Garrett's impulses? Poor Mindy! It's not freedom. No one wants that. No, true freedom is accepting the right restraints, the right rules. And if Jesus is who he said he is, then he is going to only give us constraints that lead to our flourishing. It's hard. It's hard to swallow that pill because I've had so many authority figures bloated with their power. And it's hard for me to say, okay, Rabbi Jesus, I will let you drive. That's hard. It's hard to let someone else sit as the premier authority in your life. Bonhoeffer was more emphatic. He said, in becoming Jesus' disciples, Jesus bids you to come and die. Like this is, you're no longer sitting at the driving wheel. He expects you to allow him to teach you. It's tough. And the last thing that Rabbi Jesus expects of his disciples is that they will multiply. From here on, you'll see them being sent out to make other disciples. In the end here, when Jesus is right at the end, he gives these men what has become known as the Great Commission. He says to them in Matthew 28, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. This is how the Jewish educational system was meant to work. These disciples would follow a rabbi, say from 17 until their early 30s. And then the rabbi would turn to his disciple and say, okay, son, now it's time for you to become a rabbi. Go and make disciples. Jesus is doing the very same thing. Working with this matrix of rabbi-disciple relationship, expecting his disciples to go make disciples. Robert Coleman wrote probably the best-selling book about discipleship. It now has 4 million copies in 133 languages, and it's super skinny. And I love, he says, Jesus' concern was not with programs to reach the multitudes, but with men whom the multitudes would follow. My favorite author, Eugene Peterson, adds that Jesus spent 90% of his time so that one day he could reach, 90% of his time with 12 men, so that one day he could reach all Americans. But, I mean, I disagree a little. He spent his time with 12 men, so those 12 men would reach 12 men, who would reach 12 men, who eventually one day would reach those Americans. But people are the program. People are the program. This is about these men's lives changing and them inviting others to walk alongside them as they change and inviting them in to real conversations about life. This is our last pill to swallow, because I find this one is one people just don't want to swallow. I'm with these boys. I feel unqualified. I feel too busy, too old, too young. Like, man, these young people, I don't know how to. In my work, like, one of the biggest gaps I face is age, and I work with people from all over the world, but I don't know how to relate to these young people. I'm not qualified, right? Or we've said, you know what, like, isn't this what Zach's for? Like, come on, let's just, like, don't we pay him for this? That's easy to think that. Like, don't we have, like, these professional Christians that can do this sort of thing? Take it off. I'm too shy. Introverted. Ooh, that's a good buzzword. I don't like people. Like, I don't know how to work with them. Yeah, I hear that. I am quite extroverted, so I can laugh. But I feel that introversion. But that introversion doesn't mean you don't work with people. It just means you need a little bit more time than I do to get away from people and take a break and be refreshed. Right? We have all kinds of excuses, and it's hard. It's hard to go across the room and say, hey, my name is Garrett. I notice you're new. Like, how are you doing? What's your name? This is hard stuff. And doesn't taste good. Last pill. I have noticed, like, I don't know what you would call the career that Mindy and I are on. It feels like 20 years ago, Mindy and I sort of left the career path and just sort of, like, went off in the woods with Jesus. But one thing we've done a lot of is we've helped people who feel very unqualified to try to make disciples. We've done a lot of that. And I have good news. I believe this is possible. I have seen it over and over again. When God can take little initiative and do amazing things with it. One of my favorite stories was of an older gentleman named David Berger, who was, I think, 80 when I met him. And he had come to our inner city ministry to be a mentor. And I matched him up with a 10-year-old boy named Sanford. And Sanford was always in trouble, but he was always smiling. Like, you just wanted to hug. He had such a big smile. He was a bigger kid, and he was always stealing from you, but you just loved him. You sort of just, like, let him do it because he had just this great nature about him. One of my favorite stories of Sanford is he shows up to our, like, nonprofit, which is across the street from his school, and he tries to sell us candy bars. And we're like, okay, just so we can go, like, this field trip or something. And so we're like, yeah, sure, Sanford, let me find some money. Sanford, what flavors do you have? And he said, well, I had peanut butter, I had chocolate, I had cherry, vanilla. Wait, Sanford, you had? What do you mean, Sanford? Why are you using the past tense? Well, Mr. Garrett, I ate them. I already ate the chocolate bars. I just need you to buy them, because I've already eaten them. And Sanford and David were just like, they're so different. So very different. And I just could not imagine. I'm like, David wants to do this. I cannot imagine how he could go with Sanford. And every month for 10 years, David just showed up. There, David's here again with Sam, and Sanford's here. Sanford came again because I don't know what the match is. I don't even know how this is working, but you could see David became the most important adult in Sanford's life. And towards the end of David's life, Sanford was just such a good thing for David at the very end of his life. I feel this now. I'm trying to be a rabbi to one of my dear friends, Shaquille, who's currently locked up in prison in Louisiana. And Shaquille has nobody. I get this sense that I'm the only one he has. And he calls me twice a month, and we get to talk for 12 minutes. And I can't call him back. If I miss the call, I can't call him back. I have to leave whatever I'm doing right away to call Shaquille. And I always say, "What's up, Shaq? How you doing? What you up to?" "Nothing. I'm in jail. I'm doing the same. What's happened since I last talked to you?" "Nothing. Nothing happens." And then I'm sorry, Shaq. I know. Sorry. Nothing's happened. I ask him that again just because I say that to all my friends. "What's up? What's been happening?" "Nothing, Garrett. Nothing's happening." I feel so unqualified to walk with Shaq through this trial he's facing. And yet, I'm the only one he has. If this doesn't happen, then this movement of Jesus doesn't spread. It just goes out. But these 12 disciples from this day then go and they multiply. The most popular book on discipleship that's just come out actually is very good at talking about following Jesus and excellent at talking about listening to Jesus. It's got to be one of my favorites. And it does not have the third chapter. There is nothing about multiplying. He cuts it out completely. I don't know. Maybe because we don't want to swallow that pill. But I said at the beginning that the reason I'm here is because someone took this passage seriously and it talked me down off the cliff. About the year I was born, a man named Kenny, whom I've never met, was at Kent State University, a place I've never been, in Ohio. And there was this young guy who had a lot of energy and was curious, wanted to ask a lot of questions about life. And Kenny was following Rabbi Jesus and taking Luke chapter 6 very seriously. And so Kenny, quite afraid, walks across the room to talk to a man named Dave. And he plants a seed that he would never know. He never know what would come of. He met with Dave for a year, talked about Rabbi Jesus, tried to listen to Rabbi Jesus, and then Dave went off and Kenny never again saw him. Kenny would never know the seed he planted until this Friday when I called him. Because in preparing for this message, I wanted to do a little investigating. So I was trying to track what happened. Apparently, Kenny went across the room and talked to Dave. And that relationship so shaped Dave that Dave spent the next 40 years of his life making disciples. Dave has so many young men that he's invested in that he cannot even count. But one of those men was a guy named Danny. Danny then walked across the room, scared, timid, to talk to Doug. Right? Doug now is in Florida. He spent his whole adult life making disciples. Kenny doesn't know Doug, right? And my freshman year of college, when I've arrived on the scene, ready to jump, like, let, This is where there's no limits. My parents are gone. No one knows who I am. I can pick who I am, right? The first day in my dorm room, in walks this guy, Doug. He walks into my dorm room. And he has been one of the most influential men in all my life. And in preparation of this sermon, I called Doug. He put me in touch with Danny. Danny put me in touch with Dave. And then on Friday, I finally got in touch with Kenny. And I got to tell Kenny, hey, Kenny, you won't believe this. My name's Garrett. Do you know Dave Dickens? Yeah. I remember Dave Dickens. Okay, good. Well, I'm connected to Dave Dickens. Let me tell you a story. Because he didn't want to answer my call. And I was like, no, you need to listen to this. This seed you planted a long time ago has changed my life. Thank you for taking Luke chapter 6 seriously. Calvin, I think this is happening in our church. I see it. It makes me very happy. People are coming up to my own kids in this church, tapping them on the shoulder. Come with me. I see it. I've never seen anything quite like this, this intergenerational care that I see here. And I think the word that keeps coming back to me for you guys is, this is beautiful. Keep it up. Keep it up. Jesus wants you to be with him. He wants you to become like him. And he wants you to multiply. And I think it's worth it. Back to Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I urge you to consider handing in what is calculated and observable for a life of infinite possibility. Let's pray. God, we thank you for this word. It's simple. There's not much going on, but it is beautiful. It's a good reminder that you expect obedience, but you also are going to turn things on their heads and do more than we could ever imagine. May it be so in Calvin and in the world. Amen.